Hello and welcome to Thinking Poker Podcast from sunny Las Vegas. I'm Andrew Brokus.
And from sunny and very hot Somerville, Massachusetts, I'm Nate Mavis. How are you doing, Andrew?
How hot, sir?
93 today, I believe.
Oh, wow. That's not a lot cooler than Las Vegas.
Yeah, and more humid. And gambling is not legal. So I think you win all around, really. So how's it going? How's it feel to be out there?
Oh, it's great. I'm really excited. Those of you who've been following my blog, well, now my girlfriend and I drove across the country and took close to 2 weeks to do it from Baltimore. And I actually departed from her in Flagstaff. She's bound for Austin, Texas, where I'll be meeting her later in the month. But I drove the last bit of the way. Basically, I rented a car in Flagstaff, drove it to Las Vegas. I guess they have some deals going on right now because they're trying to get cars into Las Vegas. So I was able to do that for like $20, which I think ordinarily if you're returning a rental car somewhere other than where you picked it up, it's usually like a $100 fee for that. And so I was able to do that for about $20. And then I got to Las Vegas, returned that car, took a cab to another rental car place where I was able to get a better rate. And now I have a car rented for about 3 weeks. So Nick Kest for the win.
Fantastic. Renting cars in Vegas is something that I don't know why more people don't do. I've gotten it for as low as something like $12 or $13 a day with all taxes and fees included. It's great.
And it's so nice just being able to, well, I'm not in a hotel this year either, which is pretty nice. But even the years that I was in a hotel, I mean, just being able to get to a grocery store and that kind of thing and not be stuck eating on the strip constantly, it's really huge.
Yeah.
So it feels good to have my own place. I went to the grocery store yesterday, got some coffee, just like getting settled in. I feel like I live here already.
Fantastic. And you've already fired a bullet in a tournament?
It's true. I was out of the $1,500 six max in less than 2 hours, which is a story that'll show up on the blog. It's actually not terribly interesting. It was just I'll talk about it on the blog. I don't think we want to get into it right now, but it was not a particularly interesting spot, I don't think.
I mean, if 300 people cash, then busting really fast is the 301st best thing you could do.
So. Right. Gives me time to record a podcast today.
Yeah, exactly. So I also encourage you all to read the blog as Andrew and chronicles the drive out there. It was a lot of good stuff there. A lot of fun to read.
Well, I'm glad you've been enjoying it.
Yeah.
And you're getting yourself into some trouble on the internet. Or not really trouble.
Yeah. It's World Series time. I'm updating poker news a lot. And this will stop soon because soon it'll sink in that all this stuff is completely inaccurate unless it was written by Martin Harris. So soon I'll just like go back to following like certain poker players on Twitter. But yeah, I bought pieces of some people. I'm following the action. I got a little bit of side betting going on. And I'm also causing a ruckus on 2+2. So it's poker season.
has that thread gotten more ruckusy? I haven't checked in since you first sent it to me like a week ago.
No, it stayed polite and it's died down a little bit. So what happened is this guy, Primordial AA, who I guess is famous, and I don't think anybody disputes that he's world class when it comes to short stack heads up poker, or at least heads up hyper turbos or things like that. But he is selling shares for the 10K World Series event. And what's really interesting is that he's selling them with 25% markup. Now, this is a very tough field. You know, people chimed in saying, well, this is outrageous. This is, you know, this is crazy. Can I short this? Which I think is awesome. Unfortunately, 2+2 doesn't let you short packages, but I think that would be really nice. And one of Primordial's defenses was like, look, guys, why didn't somebody just do the math before you got all up in my face about this? Because if I have a 53% win rate against the field, against an average person in the field, then my ROI is, I don't know, something big. I think it's in the 40s by his calculation. Other people came back and they said, well, but you're forgetting that better players beat worse ones. So even if you're better than the random player by at that rate, you're not going to have that win rate in the second round and beyond. Anyway, and there were these arguments back and forth. And what I thought was ridiculous is that this is a very easy, comparatively easy question to simulate. And now I guess I write software, among other things, for a living. So I thought, well, why don't I just simulate this? So I did, I think is the obvious thing. I just ran millions and millions of heads up tournaments using last year's field size and last year's pay structure, though I also tweaked those things. And I took, you know, the sort of consensus best guess as to the distribution of skill in the field. And I took a standard way to estimate the winning chances based on the overall winning chances per round of the two people who play the match. And then I just ran out the tournament, you know, 250,000 times per situation for many, many, many different situations. And long story short is that the results were not kind to Primordial. So one of his numbers was 53.5%. You know, he thought he would have, you know, if that was his win rate against the average opponent, he would have this huge ROI. And although these numbers change a little bit depending on what you assume about the field, the distribution of strength in the field, so you can hold one person's average win rate against a random opponent fixed, but if you vary the distribution of skill levels that leads to that average win rate, you're going to get different ROIs. Basically, if the same number of people show up as showed up last year, and if the World Series pays out people in the same way, and if Primordial has a 53.5% average win rate against randomly drawn opponents from the field, his ROI in the tournament, as best as I can estimate it, is between 18% and about 23%, depending what you assume about that distribution. Now, never mind that that's below his markup. So if that's the case, then people buying at 1.25 are losing money. He actually said that it was pretty much a slam dunk conclusion that he's much more than 25% in terms of ROI. And if he had 26% ROI, he wouldn't sell. He thinks that investors are getting a really good deal by doing this. You know, so I went back and I gave him 54% and things like that. And it's really hard to make plausible assumptions where Primordial comes out as having a much higher than 25% win rate. You know, if you give him 54% average win rate, then, you know, depending on what other things you assume, his ROI comes out somewhere in the high 20s or even up into the mid 30s if you make things really generous for him. And of course, now people are going back and saying that, well, given the structure, actually he might be even better than 54% against a random opponent. But this seems to me to be a clear case of post hoc modification of the case. Yeah, that was my way of trying to contribute to the community a bit and actually do some simulation and try to figure something out. So it's a rare case where you can actually model a poker tournament with such precision. Like, I think I have actual respectable conclusions here.
Yeah, and this is a thing that's pretty specific to this being a heads-up tournament, yes. Right? It's much easier to make this kind of simulation out of a heads-up tournament than it would be for a 10-handed or even in a 6-handed field.
Yes, absolutely. And in fact, I think some of our best guides to those ROIs are just empirical, just see what the best people have been doing over large samples. I mean, even there, you're going to run into problems with selection bias where you're going to get samples from people who have run well or played well or whatever. So, I mean, that's tough, but I think it's hard to sort of model it from the ground up, those other kinds of tournaments. But in a heads-up tournament, it's pretty, I mean, there are some tricky things, like it's not clear that you can just like stick a number on somebody's back and that's how good he is, which is what I'm assuming. But I think that's not a large source of error. I think actually I've modeled it in a very precise way, just because, I mean, it's pretty easy to do on a computer these days. You just generate a field with certain skill levels, then you make them play each other and you keep track of who won and who lost, and you randomly make them play each other. Then you see who makes this run, who makes that run, who wins.
Yeah, I mean, you could certainly try to make it more precise by saying, like, well, you know, maybe there are some people who play well in the early, you know, who play well in the early rounds, but then they'll be intimidated by the what's at stake in the later rounds, and maybe they won't remain 53% ROI players, or maybe there are people who are, you know, 48% ROI players, but they become 52% ROI players when the pressure is really on. I mean, you could try to say stuff like that, but I don't see why it would be necessary or yeah. Increase your accuracy in any way.
Yeah, and it's just so tiny. It's just those effects will be pretty small, and right. If you just give them sort of some kind of weighted average of everything they might be doing, it's going to be very, very close.
I guess there's some question here as to
any questions.
Yeah, I mean, one, I don't think, at least when I last looked at the thread, no one had really you know, tried to say that you were out of line in this or anything. But I mean, I guess there's some question.
Check again. Yes.
Okay. So there are people saying, like, this is none of your business, and you shouldn't be jumping in here, and because you were not one of the people who bought action from.
No, hell no. I mean, sorry. No, I chose not to invest in this particular.
So the question is then, you know, is this any of your business, or should you have just shut up while two other people were making a contract that didn't involve you?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are several things to say here. First is that you're not allowed to short on 2+2. So the overall rules greatly favor sellers. And one thing that we can all do, especially because that's 2+2.
Can we clarify for a second what you mean by short?
Oh, yeah. A short means, let's say I'm a rich person. Call me Vanessa. And say that this fictional character thinks that Primordial is making a ridiculous bet and that the package is actually negative EV at 1.25. This person can come in and say, look, I'll short it at, you know, one at 1.25. So if you want this action, you can buy it from me. You don't have to buy it from Primordial. And then you give me 1.25% of however much you want, and then I'll pay you that fraction of anything he wins.
And she could even do that for less than 1.25, right? I mean, she could
that's
1.24 in order to get the action rather than Primordial, for instance.
That's right. And then the idea is that the price will find, it'll find the true market price, which I think would have come out below 1.25 in this case, because a certain person named Vanessa actually did offer to short it before finding out that this was against the terms and conditions of 2+2. But yeah, so because things are set up that way, and for good reason, because how many people can actually really short something? I mean, you have to have a pretty good bankroll to do that, you know, because, and I think Mason intends 2+2 as a place where we both disseminate and advance poker knowledge, right? Yeah, I think it's a benefit to the community to do that. And once I got into more of the details of some of the more general things I was concluding in my simulation, I started a different thread so that I wasn't just posting entirely in Primordial's thread saying, oh, this, he made this false claim and this false claim and this false claim and this false claim. And if these eight things he said are true, then he doesn't even have a 25% ROI. But yeah, I think it's entirely appropriate that we work together to advance the state of poker knowledge. You know, it's a, for whatever reason, I think no, very few people have done these kinds of simulations before. So I think I'm actually giving something to the community and in a socially beneficial way.
You are also doing it in the context, like, it's not like this was just a hypothetical where you were like, I wonder what possible ROIs are like. I mean, you this did very specifically come up in the context of at least implicitly, if not explicitly, advising people not to buy a package that was posted.
Yeah, that's right. Right. That's right. I should say one thing, which is that Primordial was very much a gentleman when it came to me. I thought that I was a little bit snarky about some of the things that he had said to other people before, because I thought that they were crazy and false. But the exchanges between us directly, I think were very civil. And I have a lot of respect for the way he dealt with me specifically. In fact, among other things, giving me explicit permission to keep on posting in his thread, which I thought that was nice. But yeah, there are a lot of questions here. I mean, one is just, is this appropriate? And I think the answer is yes. Part of what we do is to increase knowledge together and sort of regulate the marketplace economy together. And part of the way that this regulation happens, because the rules favor the sellers, is that the buyers work to disseminate information. And that's just how it is. Another kind of question is whether it's some kind of scam or whether Primordial would be doing something bad if he were selling a package that he knew to be minus EV for the buyer. Now, first, Primordial said that that's not what was going on, that he wouldn't do it even if he had like a 26 or 27% ROI. But there's still a hypothetical question.
Yeah, and let's be very clear, though. I mean, because I think that's true. I mean, I think in all likelihood, this was just a matter of him not really understanding how to calculate or estimate what his edge was going to be in this tournament. It doesn't seem like there's any indication that he was intentionally trying to put one over on people. So let's just be clear that we're talking hypothetically when we...
Yeah, absolutely. And yeah, I mean, for a lot of reasons, this has to be a pure hypothetical. I mean, there's a different question about whether he should do his due diligence, but never mind. I mean, like, if he looks at my results, he comes to believe that he has something like a 20% ROI in this tournament. Like, is he doing something wrong selling at 1.25 if he thinks the people will buy it? I mean, I would never sell at 1.25 if I thought I had a 20% ROI, but what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think the only case that you can make for it, and I think this is maybe a plausible argument, that posting a package and selling action carries an implied assertion that you believe it's a plus EV investment. I mean, certainly it would be unethical for him to come in and say something that isn't he didn't believe to be true. So if he sat down and literally said, I believe my theoretical edge in this tournament is 140%, I'm selling at 125%, right? But he didn't actually believe it was 140%. That, yeah, I think would be straightforwardly unethical. I think to just come in and say, hey, I'm selling at 125, you can buy it if you want, without explicitly saying anything about whether he actually believes that's a good investment for you, I think that's a somewhat trickier case. There are, in theory, reasons why people might buy action other than believing it's a plus EV investment. The most obvious being that they want to sweat. This would be particularly important if it were like a famous player or something. There might be people who enjoy rooting for for Doyle Brunson, and they would buy a package from him, at, even if they knew it was potentially a negative EV investment, for the same reason that people make bad bets on their favorite sports team. They want to bet on someone they like, and they're not particularly concerned about whether or not it's plus EV. So in theory, I think there could be reasons why someone might do this. Obviously, it's very bad for a player's reputation to do this. I mean, I think you would quickly have trouble selling action if it became clear that you were doing things like this. And I do also think that there probably is some kind of implied, just the way the 2+2 marketplace works. I mean, I think it is intended to be a place, and is largely a place, where people are trying to make plus EV investments. And I think that by posting, it's a little disingenuous. And again, no one has actually said this, but it's a little disingenuous if you were to say like, oh, well, I just put a package up there. I mean, I never said I thought it was plus EV. Like, I think that posting a package does imply that you are trying to offer a mutually beneficial investment.
I think that's right. I think the norms are like that even off the internet. Like, if I walk up to you in a casino and I say like, hey, why don't you put me in this tournament and, you know, I'll play for 10% of myself. You know, like, I think I am representing that you come out ahead even after the rake, even after you pay me 10% of any cash, you know. And I think that's just how it goes. It might not be a good idea for you to do that, but I think that's part of what you represent.
Yeah, I would say it's not something that you should do, to post a package that you don't believe is plus EV, unless you explicitly say that. I mean, if you want to say like, in past years, I've been reluctant to sell action generally in the WSOP main event. And in past years, I've had people approach me privately and just say like, hey, are you selling any action, or I really want to sweat, or something like that. And so, you know, I've told them, you know, I've named a price that I thought was, I mean, I didn't put a lot of math into this, but I sort of named a price that was pretty high and probably like break even at best for them. But I explicitly said, I was like, look, I'm really not that interested in selling action. If you really want to sweat, like, here's the price where I'd be indifferent as to whether or not you bought it. And so I tried to make clear that I wasn't naming a price that I believed would be a good investment for that person, but rather just naming a price where I was like, well, if you really want to buy, yeah, this is what it would cost you, and, you know, it's up to you.
I think that's right. And I think that would change if there were shorting allowed in the marketplace. Like, if there was more like a free market, then I think I would have very different instincts about this. And I think you could just put up the package and pick a price and let the market say what it will.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about this, decision not to allow people to come in and short other people's packages or undercut other people's packages.
Yeah.
Because, yeah, there's the obvious disadvantage of not having a fully self-regulating market, or not seeing, as you say, benefits sellers, because you can go on there, you can put up a price, and no one's allowed to compete against you on selling your action, right? I mean, you could, there might be other people playing the same tournament who are selling at a more reasonable price, and people could buy from them. So it's not entirely without competition. But if you want to buy Primordial AA's action, your only option is either buy it from Primordial or work out something not going through 2+2 to buy from Vanessa, for instance. So I think that there are some reasons, in addition to the obvious, that like, logistically, it's difficult to guarantee that a person other than the person who, like, if Primordial wins the tournament, you know that Primordial has the money to pay out his investors, assuming he sold less than 100% of himself, because he gets the money for winning the tournament. If someone else has shorted him, you know, they have to be prepared to pay out a pretty large amount if he happens to win an extremely large prize. As you say, there's relatively few people who are going to be bankrolled for that, and you know, you potentially get into like escrow issues or issues of needing to establish that the person actually has the bankroll. So I think there are some practical complications related to that. It's more obvious to me that there's a public benefit to the poker world in, like, I think it may be okay to privilege sellers. I think there's a benefit to the poker world at large by having more people enter tournaments, which is what selling action does. You know, making it possible for people to raise money to play tournaments means larger fields, and I think that's just generally good for poker. It means more money is in circulation. I don't know that there's actually much of a community incentive to protect investors from their own bad decisions.
I mean, it does inflate the prices that even smart investors have to pay. And you might think that causing unfair outcomes to devolve on sort of well-intentioned people is a bad thing for the poker world.
Yeah, I guess it seems like certainly it's a less immediate problem. I mean, obviously, like,
people... It's a very immediate problem. It happened to me today. it's totally immediate. It's more immediate than the economy effects that you mentioned.
But... Well, I guess what I mean, though, is that, I mean, the implication for the poker world is, you know, maybe people are less willing to take the risk of buying action. Like, if it's well known that there are people who are posting on 2+2 selling packages that aren't plus EV, then the people who who aren't real informed investors, who just kind of like speculate in the market, might be less willing to do that. Or people who are making bad investment decisions may lose their money and not be able to invest in the future. Prices, I mean, the point about prices being driven up higher, like if people aren't buying, then the person can lower their price. And if people are buying, then it's not really a community problem. I guess I'm kind of looking at things that are going to hurt the poker community as a whole, as opposed to things that are just going to hurt the person who made a bad investment.
I'm just confused about the economics here. So if some price control or whatever goes into effect such that the price of water is 5 cents per gallon higher than it would be, but I buy it anyway, something bad has still happened to me. I'm paying too much for water, right?
It's happened to you, but I don't see why that's a problem for anyone other than you.
Well, sure, but it's a problem for the poker world insofar as bad things are happening to the people in it. What does it mean?
But a good thing that's happening to the person is on the other end of the bargain. I mean, one poker player has lost money, another poker player has made theoretical money.
Well, I mean, yeah, but if poker games were like systematically rigged, that wouldn't be a neutral thing for the poker world. We all benefit from somewhat more equitable. I guess I have this instinct where in some cases it's correct to disrupt the free market, but in a case like this, I see no compelling reason to disrupt the free market, and the sort of just outcome seems to be the one that the free market would arrive at.
I guess what I'm saying is given the logistical difficulties of enabling a shorting market, and I do think also that like it might discourage people from posting packages if they feel like it's a lot of work involved. Like they can't just put up a package and then respond booked as people buy percentages of them. If instead they have to, I guess, on the lookout for people undercutting them, or maybe even like from, I mean, I don't think it's like a huge, like I wouldn't mind if they decided to start allowing shorting, but I can understand a decision not to. I think some people might be discouraged from even trying to sell action if shorting existed, and not only because they feel like they might not get a price that they want. I think there might just be other reasons why people would be uncomfortable with other people. Like, I mean, it's essentially calling them out. Like when someone undercuts you, I guess they're essentially calling you out.
Or no, I see your point. That's your point.
To post action, to sell action.
Sure. I don't agree with it, but I do see the point. And I mean, especially given that it would cause all kinds of problems for 2+2 and they're doing the community a service by having the marketplace open, then whatever.
certainly they can set their own rules. It's their marketplace. Yeah.
There seems to me like the way things currently are, something wrong with charging 25% when you only have a 15% ROI, just as there seems to be something wrong with promoting lock and asking people to deposit on it these days, which I know Primordial's, he said he's probably going to be wearing a lock patch in the events, and I think he's still affiliated with lock. And I have to say, I didn't do this to just give him a hard time for doing that, but I am kind of happy that it worked out that way. So.
Well, let me ask you one other question. You know, what happens if this discussion takes place after the tournament? You know, so he plays, whether or not he cashes, or actually, I mean, let's assume that he doesn't cash. That's probably the more important case. He doesn't cash, and then you or someone comes in and more or less proves that his package was not actually plus EV, given the assumptions that he, you know, if he states, I believe I'm a 53% player, and you can more or less prove a 53% player doesn't have the edge to make that investment a good investment, does he owe anything to the people who bought action from him?
No, I don't think so, just because, I mean, for a lot of reasons. Yeah, I mean, just because you've done something wrong doesn't always mean that you owe something to the people you wronged. And it's just a little bit like that was kind of a bad thing to do. Like, yeah, you know, just he did what he thought was due diligence, which was to raise 0.535 to a certain power, then subtract the answer from, you know, then compute the ROIs from that. Just an aside, I don't think he ever actually said that he believed his win rate would be that, but he did sort of imply that it wouldn't be that much higher than that. And he said that he would clearly have, you know, a nice high ROI, even if his win rate was only 0.535. No, but I don't think he would own anything. Do you?
Yeah, no, because I mean, I think if you just think about the reciprocal case, like what if he sold action at what turned out to be an absurdly low price? I mean, he's not in a position to demand more money from backers after the fact, or like to pay out a smaller percentage of his winnings than he otherwise would. I don't think it's fair to impose a burden one way but not the other. I mean, ultimately, it is a contract, and both people agree to it, and there is, I think, also some burden on the buyers to do some due diligence. I mean, that said, he might, from a practical point of view, choose to do something about it. And this is actually something that I ended up doing with some people who bought action from me once. There was a when I played the WSOP Europe, I assumed the field was going to be a lot softer than it was, and I think I actually, had I done some research on the field or on, you know, how many people were expected and that kind of thing, I think I could have determined that it was not going to be as similar to the WSOP main event as it is. And so I ended up just working out privately with the people who bought action from me, I basically gave them the chance to buy action from me in a future tournament at no markup at all. It's kind of an apology for that. And I mean, I don't think any of them expected that. And a few of them explicitly said that, you know, they didn't feel that was necessary. But I mean, and that was really, it's not that I felt really a moral obligation to do it as much as just, I thought it was good business. You know, I value my investors and I want people to feel like they're comfortable investing with me. And if it turns out that I've really made a big mistake in estimating what a field is going to look like, you know, that I'm not just going to hose them on that.
Yeah, no, I would do the same thing. And I think it's probably a good thing to do, both for Prudential and for other reasons. So,
and that seemed like the better, rather than just like trying to give people cash back or something. I thought giving them an opportunity to make a very clearly plus EV investment in the future was maybe the best compromise there.
You know, it's funny because some people say that I'm the kind of person who you should also be suspicious of in the marketplace. Like, so I'm somebody who plays not that many tournaments, and I'm selling at 1.3 for the main events, and I'm selling, you know, over 50%, actually a little bit over 60% of myself. So I'm not free rolling. I'm not even close to free rolling, especially if you deduct expenses getting out to Las Vegas. But I am, you know, some working stiff who's charging 1.3 for his yearly big tournament, you know, and I think some people think that's too much. But I really can produce arguments where I think I have way more than a 30% ROI in the main.
Yeah, I mean, I would think that you do. And I mean, I think, again, like you can tell people those things, or, you know, as long as you're upfront about those things, or you're not deceptive about those things anyway, then I mean, people can decide for themselves whether or not they believe that you'll have that edge.
And I have a waiting list, as I've had every year for a while, at least. So yeah, there's actually one person who said that he's more comfortable investing in me because of my public relationship with you. So, you know, that you're improving the market for shares of me in tournaments. I'm sure that makes you feel good.
Yeah, don't make me look bad.
I probably do that enough publicly. So.
Today's strategy segment is sponsored by Tournament Poker Edge. A lot of good videos going up there now, and more to be going up soon. We've got the conclusion of Mike Sauer's double final tables in a 1K multi-entry tournament. So this, of course, was slightly before Black Friday, but a pretty big accomplishment to make two final tables in the same tournament. And he runs through complete hand histories of both of those tournaments. So I think that's, I think Sauer's is a very good player, and there's a lot of interesting stuff that comes up in that series, so definitely worth taking a look there. Also, Ben Warrington, who you might know as Kid Cardiff 6, he's been a pretty successful both live and online poker, and he is doing a new theory series on advanced MTT strategy, and this one is focusing specifically on preflop, but I think it has some similarities to some of the theory videos that I've done for TPE. If you enjoyed those, he's got some more theory stuff coming up, and if you've been enjoying my series on TPE, or if you've been interested in my series on TP but are not yet a subscriber, I've been running through a WCOOP event that I nearly final tabled. That's an extremely long hand history, and so I've broken it up into a couple of parts, but the second part is going to be going up soon, and that really has an emphasis on late game play, both pre and post flop. So a lot of interesting stuff showing up on tournamentpokeredge.com, and if you're not already a member, that's where you can sign up.
Excellent. Hey, speaking of theory, have you checked out Matt Janda's new book?
No, but I want to.
I started reading it. It's interesting so far. It seems to be a place that doesn't quite exist in the poker literature that I've seen yet. It's not quite Shannon Ankenman sophisticated from a game theory perspective, but it's much more focused on no limit hold'em. So it's like a very counting combinations and balancing your ranges from a game theory perspective treatment of no limit. So
yeah, it seems like a good book for a 2+2 to publish.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I've started it. I think it's good in some ways so far. I have some fairly serious issues with it also so far, but I think it's very interesting, and I'm glad I'm reading it. Maybe something to talk about on the air. Not today, because today we have a really good strategy hand, but you know.
Yeah, I could see that as a future book club book, and maybe it's worth flagging to people right now. We're not going to be doing a book club for the month of June. I think we're going to have a little less time for recording than usual with my being in Las Vegas. So there's not going to be a book club for June, and we may or may not resume that in July, depending on whether we have a good candidate, but it sounds like we might. Anyway, our strategy hand today is coming from the Charlestown Casino in West Virginia. This was a 1-2 no limit game, and our hero describes it as fairly typical live stakes no limit game, a lot of passive players. The villain in this hand has $700, hero has $260, so that's going to be the effective stacks. Our hero says that the villain has been active in the hands he's been dealt, rarely making it to showdown. He's made some good c-bets, and he's opened about 40% of his hands pre-flop. Hero believes that villain perceives hero as loose aggressive, also entering a lot of pots and playing aggressively pre and post-flop. A couple people limp in, and then the villain in middle position makes it $11. And our hero chooses to flat on the cutoff with 10-8 suited. So let's start there. How do we like the decision to play this hand, and if we're going to play it, to play it by calling?
Like, you know, there's an argument for three betting. And if you're not comfortable after the flop in one of a bunch of ways, like maybe if you thought this guy was the best 1-2 no limit player in the state, maybe you could fold it. But I think you're deep enough that you can play it profitably, and I'd rather call than three bet with this hand. What do you think?
Yeah, I think a lot actually depends on the size of villain's raise. You know, I don't want to say that you should just like always be calling. There's a couple limpers and then a guy raises, that you should just, you know, snap call with 10-8 suited when you're
Line. Frequently not, but
yeah, I mean, in this particular case, this raise is actually not that large with if there's been a couple of limpers in front already. There's a good chance that this hand is going to go multi-way, and you're putting in less than 5% of the effective stacks. So and you don't want to look at that purely from an implied odds point of view, like as though you're just only playing this hand to try to make two pair or better, because it's not like that's going to happen all that often, or that you're going to stack him all that often. We talked about that math in previous strategy segments. But having more room to maneuver generally when you're, I guess, on the cutoff, is pretty likely hero is going to end up having absolute position in this hand. And position is more valuable the deeper you are. So the more money that goes in pre-flop, the less room there's going to be for hero to use this position in any number of ways post-flop. If the villain had raised to $16 or $20, which I don't think would be unheard of with a couple of limpers in front in a 1-2 game, then I would probably fold this. So yeah. I think it's significant that we're getting a pretty good price. And also, I do think there could be a case for three betting if you read villain's raise size as weak. If you think that he would have raised larger with a stronger hand, then I would pretty seriously consider three betting him.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think if I had to pick one number now, I think I would call $13 but fold for $14.
That sounds about right to me. That's not really, I mean, that happens to be 5% of the stacks. I don't know, that has a lot to do with my decision. That just kind of feels right to me. So hero calls in the cutoff with his 10-8 suited, and all the limpers fold. So it ends up being heads up between hero and the villain with $29 in the pot before the rake is taken out. So probably $27 or $26 actually in the pot. And the flop comes jack of spades, deuce of hearts, six of spades. Villain continuation bets for $20. And hero raises to $65. And we should say, I think part of the reason why hero chose to flat this hand pre-flop, this is another instance of me trying to summarize a hand and cutting out some important information, that Hero's, our correspondent, said part of the reason he wanted to call this raise pre-flop is that he believed that he would have opportunity, that this guy continuation bet a lot, and he thought it would probably be profitable just to bluff raise his continuation bets. So how do we feel about this as a spot?
I mean, if you have position and somebody's continuation betting too much, then it's hard for a bluff raise to be that far wrong, especially because the 10 and the 8 might be some good and you have backdoor straight draws, although that hardly matters here. I'm a little bit worried that he's continuation betting 20 into something like 25. I think a lot of these people have, you know, people who c-bet too much at 1-2 games have bet sizing issues where if they don't have something, they'd be more likely to bet about 15. I also think that if you want to bluff, floating the flop might be a better thing to do. First, because you can get good information on the turn. Second, because if somebody's one of these maniac types, I'm not saying he is, but the more maniacal somebody is, the more likely they are to think that a flop raise just means absolutely nothing at all, especially with a flush draw on board. Like, it's hard ever to say that, you know, you find a guy with a weak range on a dry board and you have position and there's money left to bet. I mean, this raise puts quite a bit of pressure on him, right? So it's like hard to say that this is a bad raise. I mean, there's a lot to like about it, but I'm not sure if there aren't other ways to take this pot away better. And I also doubt whether this is really the pot to take away. I would want to be very confident before I, given the c-betting size, before I decided to bluff at this pot. with this hand. You know, there are other hands to do it. But, you know, might as well have like one over card or.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think a lot comes down to the level of confidence the hero has in this. I mean, if our correspondent wants to say, I'm sure that this guy was c-betting all of the time, and I'm sure he's going to fold anything less than middle pair or a strong draw to a raise, then I think raising is clearly going to be profitable.
Yeah, that's
so
awesome, man.
it depends on your level of confidence in those assumptions. And I think that because, as you point out, Nate, because this is such a poor hand for making this play, I mean, you can imagine that Hero is probably also calling here with 10-8 of spades and 7-6 of clubs and 3-4
ace
of hearts.
Deuce of something, or maybe
yeah, like
aces.
There are quite a few better hands in Hero's range that Hero could choose to make this play with. And I think that the deeper you dig into your weak hand range, I mean, and weak hands are the best hands to bluff with. I mean, you wouldn't want to be bluff raising here with trying to bluff raise with like Jack 10 or something. I mean, you should be bluff raising with hands that don't have a lot of showdown value, but ideally they're hands that do have some drawing value. And the deeper that you dig into your weak hands to find bluffing candidates, I mean, if you start grabbing in a hand like 10-8 that doesn't even really have backdoor draws, I mean, I guess you've got some like runner perfect straight draws, most of which are not to the nuts. So you really don't even have much in the way of backdoor draws, and you don't have any overcards. When you start digging that deep to find bluffing hands, you're really deviating quite far from optimal play. You know, optimal play entails raising with some hands and folding some others. And the way you choose those, I mean, in part has to do with how much equity that hand has in the pot. So when you're bluffing with a hand this week, I mean, you should certainly be bluffing with all hands that are better bluffing candidates than this, or else there's no sense in bluffing with this one. And if you're going to have a bluffing range that wide, you've got an extremely unbalanced range, which is okay if you're exploiting a specific thing that your opponent does. And that's why I say it all comes down to the level of confidence that you have. The more that you're moving into exploitable territory, and the more that you're going to have like a hugely wide bluffing range here, which I think Hero will if he is bluffing this hand and all better bluffing candidates, the further that you deviate from an optimal bluffing strategy, the more confident you need to be in the read that you're trying to take advantage of. So I think to raise here with a hand like 3-4 of hearts, I wouldn't need to be nearly as confident in my hand as, or sorry, in my reads as I feel I would need to be to raise with 10-8 suited, where I have, you know, no even draws to speak of.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right.
I also am not wild about the size of Hero's raise. It seems needlessly large to me.
Yeah, 55 would do the job, right?
Exactly. I think it's really important when you're bluffing, and I've talked about this in the context of value betting before, that you should often have a target when you're value betting, meaning you should know specifically what are the hands you're hoping to get paid by. I think you should actually do something similar when you're bluffing. You should have an idea of what is the best hand I'm trying to make him fold, either now or on a later street. So rather than just saying, like, I'm just going to 3x his raise, I think you want to have in mind, like, what do you think is the weakest hand that he's not going to fold to a raise? Or what do you think is the strongest hand he will fold to a raise is another way of asking the same question. And then you want to raise the amount that puts maximum pressure, or not maximum pressure, but puts the right amount of pressure on that hand. So if you're trying to get him to fold hands up to pocket fives, maybe, and you think he's not going to fold a six to this raise, but he'll fold pocket fives and worse, then you want to say, you know, what do I think is the most he's going to call with pocket fives? If you're making it $65, then you're saying you believe that if you just raised to $64, he wouldn't fold pocket fives. And I think if you frame the question for yourself in that way, like, what specific hand am I trying to make him fold? So, and then presumably it's that hand plus all weaker hands. What hands am I trying to make him fold? Then maybe you can arrive at a better idea of how much to raise, because this sort of seems like overkill. I think most hands that are going to fold for 65 will, as you say, fold for 55. I think for the most part, you're just getting villain to fold when he has nothing. I think it's really quite difficult for Hero to represent many strong hands. I don't think at the spot where Hero is very likely. I mean, I don't even know for sure that Hero would raise if he had flopped a set. But I mean, in terms of like plausible, really strong hands on this flop, like all the two pair combinations are pretty unlikely for Hero. So I mean, the most likely things that Hero is representing are that he flopped a set. And with jacks, he's probably going to 3-bet pre-flop. So it's really just like flopped a set of sixes, flopped a set of deuces. Maybe Hero flopped a really big draw that he's willing to get all in with, like king, queen of spades or something.
I mean, a hand like ace-jack, if the other guy's been active, then that can be a happy raise, get it in hand.
Yeah, I mean, that's still, compared to, if you think about how large Hero's bluffing range is going to be if he's bluffing with 10-8 of clubs, I still think he's going to be really heavily weighted towards bluffs. I mean, I think even if you include ace-jack, there are still relatively few hands that Hero's going to raise for value here.
Yeah, I was probably just saying like, hey, it's okay if somebody's been really active and the pot's this big to just raise and get it in with ace jack, right? Like, yeah, okay. Good. I mean, maybe I put some of that in my calling range for other reasons, but I think my default play against an active guy like that is just to happily stack off.
See, I think Hero can't be too ambitious about the hands he's trying to get villain to fold, and consequently I don't think he should be raising that big. You know, we're not really trying to make him fold a good hand. We're just trying to make him fold all of those nothing hands that he's just auto c-betting with if Hero's read is accurate about that.
Yes. And we think that maybe the villain had some idea what was going on with Hero's range here, because what happens on the turn?
Yeah, well, first, villain asks for a count, and then he takes about 20 seconds. He counts his own stack of chips. He takes about 30 to 40 seconds more and calls. So now we go to the turn with probably about $154 in the pot. And the turn is the seven of diamonds. And villain bets $175, which is pretty much putting our hero all in.
I mean, there's no real decision there. You have to fold, so...
Yeah, I mean, I guess the hero has 10 high and a gut shot.
Yeah.
If he puts villain on 8-9, I suppose it could go.
You gotta fold. And I think this is part of the problem. If I had to guess what happened, probably villain had a strong jack and thought that he would wait to see if a spade came on the turn, then if not, just move in. He just probably decided his range is draw heavy, that's why he played the hand as he did. If he thought that it was really, really, really bluff heavy, then probably his better play would be to check and bluff catch. But if I had to guess what was going on with villain here, probably he was waiting for a safe turn.
Yeah, I think that's a good read. So thank you for the hand, correspondent.
Yes. should we not reveal his name?
I don't know. I don't remember if he explicitly asked this to.
Never mind.
Yeah, I think our default maybe should be not to give people's names unless they ask us to, because who knows whether any of his regular opponents at Charlestown play against him and they're like, oh, that guy is a listener to the Thinking Poker podcast. He must be a Thinking Poker player.
Probably a bigger deal in Canada where we're huge. I'm not sure how many West Virginian listeners we have. So somebody in West Virginia, yes, thank you for sending in the hand. And you should all send in your hands to podcast@thinkingpoker.net. And your non-hand questions too, all sorts of things.
Yeah, we are eager to get those. We've had a really good one sitting in the hopper for a while, and it's just a matter of finding the right episode to put it into. But we are interested in broader strategy questions that don't necessarily revolve around a hand as well. And we'll give our appreciation to everyone who has already submitted hands to us. We do have a bit of a queue. We're still very excited to have more coming in, so please keep them coming in. But don't be offended if you don't hear your hand discussed immediately. We do hold on to all of them. We do appreciate all of them, and we do aim to get all of them on the air eventually. Joining us from the turbulent streets of Istanbul, we've got Gareth Chandler bringing us some, not live reporting, but some on-the-scene reporting of some civil unrest in Istanbul. What's going on over there, Gareth?
That's right. There is civil unrest here. Yesterday, primarily, there were protests that began on Friday, I guess. And first of all, I should say I'm wholly ignorant of the political situation here. So this is all from the mouth of from my mouth and not anyone else's. Yeah, there was supposed to be the construction of a mall and an Ottoman barracks tribute starting on Friday in place of a green space downtown. And this was like a symbolic event. And so the people who didn't want the symbolism to go through stopped it, and there was like huge, really huge, I don't use that word lightly, protests starting Friday night and running up until now.
Well, I don't know, what's your involvement about? Are you staying out of the way, or have you like gone down to spectate or to participate?
Yeah, I went down to spectate yesterday morning. My friend spent all day protesting. So there's like a main street that's actually very well patronized by tourists called Istiklal, and it leads to this square called Taksim Square, which is where all the construction was going to happen, basically. And yeah, we got down there, I'm going to say a little before 10 in the morning. And when we first got on the street at where it more or less begins, everything was kind of dead, seemed peaceful enough. And just like 100 meters on, Like, there's some tourists wandering around going to Starbucks and, you know, just sort of doing what they do on the street. And then, yeah, a couple hundred meters down, there was one of these giant police tank cars firing this tear gas water down the street. And, yeah, it cleared us out pretty quick. So we got we walked towards that and we got caught in that pretty quickly. Like, I wasn't down there for very long at all.
And you got gassed yourself?
Yeah, I did. Yeah. I mean, we weren't fleeing the scene, right? So the police would fire tear gas at the mass of protesters who were being, I don't know about aggressive, but they were being defiant and they would like give way. The way I saw it was like the police were being kind of this weird mix of showing restraint and being really aggressive. They're being really aggressive about their territorial expansion. like it wasn't enough that they, I guess, had Taksim Square. They were just like advancing down the street. That seemed totally, not totally unnecessary, but it was kind of curious, you know, why are they pushing these people further and further back? And that's sort of where we entered the fray, I guess. And, you know, they, by restraint, I just mean, I didn't witness like anyone getting the butt of a rifle in their face or anything, right? But yeah, so we were getting pushed onto the side streets, and there's nice side streets. And in one such instance, we were recording and watching and stuff like that. The police fired tear gas down the side street behind us and then down the side street, like on the other side of the street. So yeah, we had tear gas sort of behind us and in front of us. And then, you know, we had no choice but to go back into the main street. Yeah, I just actually didn't even see it. I guess I was under the assumption that, hey, this white gas, like if you walk into that, that's going to be where tear gas is. Right. Mm-hmm. So the white gas, like in the alley behind, the white gas in the alley across, like, don't go there. We're going to have to go back onto the main street and, you know, find our way out or whatever. And yeah, that's not the case. Like, I didn't see it coming. Just sort of hit us. But just from my reading of the symptoms, I would say 2 out of 5, really mild case. You know, like I was fine in 25 minutes kind of thing.
But it was still pretty unpleasant during the...
Yeah, I was slightly disoriented and like I was crying, but and there was pain. But yeah, I don't know. It's got to be super mild compared to the real effects, you know?
Yeah.
So once I was cooking with a hot pepper and touched my eye without, and I remember having to like run to the shower and wash it out. Like, have you ever done that? Can you compare it to that?
Yeah, like I did feel like I had to wash something out, but I didn't get any water for it. Like,
okay.
I really was fine. In like 25 minutes, like totally fine. I didn't experience any after effects or anything like that. So,
all right. Like, is the pain comparable to something that I might know? Like, so like in that 25 minutes?
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. I mean, this is my experience, right? I imagine the full blast is totally debilitating and you don't, like, you have total disorientation probably and total, you're just neutralized, you know? Yeah, I still had a sense of where I was and I wanted to get out of there and I ran away, you know? But I assume, like, my experience, you've had something similar to that. I don't think either of us have probably had, like, the real experience, you know?
Yeah, surely not. Surely not.
Do you feel, like, unsafe there now or does it seem like...
No. No, I didn't even feel that unsafe actually at the time because, like I said, it seemed like the police were showing a certain kind of restraint in their tactics, you know, and there were members of the media with gas masks and like full camera kits, like literally walking with the groups of police while they were firing tear gas and stuff like that. And there was one time where we were at like the base of one of these alleys and the protesters sort of ran up the alley and my friend Emery said just like stop, don't go, you're gonna make yourself a target if you run. And the police came to the mouth of the alley, you know, saw us and like three other beleaguered non-organized people and, you know, didn't fire on us then and there, get point blank or whatever. You know, it's like pretty clear there have been police in Turkey, like most of the world are pigs, so there's been authoritarian.
See, now you've made yourself a target.
Like there have been excesses for sure, and it seems like it's going to be hard to get a grasp on the exact physical damage, how many deaths, how many casualties, hospitalizations, stuff like that. Those metrics are going to be hard to come by. yeah, there's footage of like cops kicking the shit out of people for no reason. But yeah, that's kind of not all to be expected, but I don't know.
Yeah. So what else have you been up to before all this started happening?
Yeah, just grinding. Like, we were going to go down just to go sightseeing. But I guess the day changed. My friend wanted to spend the day in protest. Yeah, honestly, not much. I got this job with PokerStars, so I'm going to be reporting for them. So I'm pretty excited about that.
And that's going to take you, what, to Spain?
Yeah, going to Marbella on the south coast of Spain, right near the Straits of Gibraltar. So I'm going there in a week, actually. Yeah, I mean, couldn't be a better gig for me. They're flying me there and paying me to do it. So, I mean, it's just like
nice.
Ridiculous. Yeah. I'm going to Norway after that. So I'm looking forward to that.
It's a busy summer ahead of you, but no WSOP this year?
No. I'm going to just been no creeping jealousy yet, but I don't know.
I haven't done anything for you to be jealous of yet.
Yeah, that's true. I was.
I think maybe you saw Gaylord is open again under a new name.
I did see that tweet, actually. That shows how creepy I am. I was railing Leo the other day on Twitter, so that was fun. Yeah, I mean, I'd really enjoy playing live MTTs, but I'm on the other side of the world, and they're expensive to buy into. Yeah. So.
And someone's paying you to go to one on that side of the world.
Yeah, exactly. I was thinking that if I do a good job in this Spain one, I might go to the one at the start of August. And I was planning on going actually to play in my own schedule. Just worked out that I could go there. And they have a 1.1K Euro main event. So that was more in line with like what my bankroll main event for the summer would be. But if I get the opportunity to, you know, to go there and come out ahead of like 95% of the players with like no yeah. variance. I mean, it wouldn't be like the dumbest thing for me to try and start putting money in the bank instead of spending it all as soon as I get it. So
true.
Is there any kind of live poker scene in Turkey?
No, not at all. I think they fly to Cyprus and to Georgia to gamble. I'm not too sure about the casinos in Cyprus, but it seems like there are casinos on both sides. And the Turks go to the Turkish side. And then Georgia, they go to, I'm blanking on the name of the city. It's not Titsbili or however you pronounce that.
Tbilisi?
Yeah, Tbilisi. But no, there's no gambling. Actually, one of the things that stoked or exacerbated the rioting the other day was this government crackdown on like liquor advertisement, alcohol consumption and advertisement and promotion. They had one of the laws, like I haven't read, again, like talking about my ignorance here. One of the laws was like, you can't sell alcohol between 10 p.m. and 6 a.m., which puts all these small businesses out of business, basically, because their whole role in the market is to provide the alcohol sales when other people can't.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's just another, this creeping Islamicization of this state that was founded on really big secular values or whatever.
Right.
In 1923, if my research is good. But yeah, so there's no poker. I mean, poker's like, they're taking away people's right to drink alcohol in public. Right. So.
Cool. So are you going to join us to talk about Mental Game of Poker 2?
Yeah, I got some.
Chapters that we haven't really talked about yet, and then we can, and I don't really have a ton to say about those chapters specifically, and then we can talk about our overall impressions of the book. So I believe we're starting off with chapter 6, which is dealing with goals, and this is one that we did talk about more extensively than some when we actually had Jared on the show, so I don't know how much more we want to add here. I mean, the impression that I took away from that conversation with Jared, and I'm still not entirely sold on the point about having results-oriented goals, but I do think there are kind of two types of results-oriented goals. And one, the kind that make that it more obvious to me that they have some sort of value, are motivational type goals, where you have in mind, because I mean, making money in its own right isn't really your goal. I mean, most people, their goal isn't just to have a big pile of money. I guess for some people that actually is their goal, but in general, there's something that you want the money for that's motivating you. And I think that's part of Jared's point, is that it can be valuable to say, I want to earn enough money to be able to quit my job, or I want to earn enough money to buy a house or go on a vacation, or just have, you know, have something in mind of what the money is going to enable you to do. And that can help to provide motivation for you to play your best, to study, to put in hours, that sort of thing. And that makes sense to me. And there may be some kind of results oriented, like there might be a number tied to that for the amount that you need to buy that house or go on vacation or whatever it is. And of course, that's going to be beyond your control, but to some extent, but I can see the motivational value of that attached to it. The other sort of results-oriented goal that I don't think is helpful is one that doesn't really have a motivational effect. And this is why I don't think it's helpful, because I think that a goal should be something that motivates behavior in some way. And it's clear, for instance, if you need to earn a certain amount of money, that you might need to do things to earn that money. Like you might need to put in hours, or you might need to work on improving your game, identify things you need to do so that you can increase your hourly rate, things like that. But if you have a results-oriented goal, like one of the examples that I gave Jared of trying to finish every level of a tournament with 100 big blinds.
Right.
I think that's just worthless, really. It doesn't motivate your behavior in any way. Like, what are you going to do differently as a result of having that goal? Are you suddenly
do things differently, but those will be mistakes.
Yeah, exactly. It could only lead you to play. I mean, your goal should already be to win every chip that you feel you're able to win. I mean, knowing that you only have 80 big blinds right now, or that you have 110 big blinds right now, you really shouldn't do anything differently in any given situation that I can think of. So I really don't see how a goal like that, and I don't know that that is really what Jared has in mind when he talks about results-oriented goals. I mean, that's my example and not his, but that's really the kind of results-oriented goal that I think is not helpful.
Yeah, I agree with that. I kind of suspect it's not the type of results-oriented goal he's talking about. I think you're right to, I mean, this might just be repetition of what you're saying. A good results-oriented goal is one that sort of organizes your action. I think one of the things Jared's pointing out is if you never have results-oriented goal, like he had this sentence about people like winning a tournament and thinking nothing of it. I'm kind of reminded of Peter Eastgate. He was so locked in, zenned out. When he won the main event, he just I'm just going to continue on this even keel, you know? And I think, because I don't usually have results. Actually, I never have results-oriented goals myself. I only have process-oriented goals. And I think having a mix of the two could be good in some ways because, if I have a goal I need to get this many VPPs by this day, that could, really organize my efforts, really make efficient the decisions I make that surround my poker playing, stuff like that. And one of the things that he points out, which is kind of, parallel to that, is one of the problems with people not setting results-oriented goals is just being inexperienced with failing. And failing's not a bad thing. You should get used to setting goals and maybe not always succeeding. So I think there's value in that too, actually.
Yeah, I think that's a good point.
But I mean,
go ahead.
I was just going to say, I mean, any poker player is going to fail a lot anyway, though. I don't set results-oriented goals, and I have no lack of failing at poker and trying to, any reflective person is going to worry about his mistakes and think about them and try to improve at them. And striving for things that are out of my control seems to just add pain to that process and pointlessness, frankly. So,
I think that's all valid too. So I guess I'm in the torn camp because, of course, you shouldn't add unnecessary pain, but I don't know. I think if I set a goal of a volume goal or the make this amount of money goal is one I'm not sold on, actually, because it is sort of out of your control in some ways.
It kind of ties in a bit maybe with the next chapter, which is about self-discipline, because I can see how obviously you can't completely control how much money you make, but you can have in mind, and I mean, especially if you're a professional, you may need to have in mind that you have to be earning a certain amount of money per month. And this is a number that I've heard Glenn's gonna call it like your monthly nut that you have to make. I don't know where he gets that.
Yeah, it's a standard phrase.
Yeah, so I mean that you may have to earn, and that doesn't mean that you should be living month to month. I mean, if you're gonna be gambling for a living, you ought to have some, you know, 6 months or a year's worth of living expenses set aside. But nonetheless, you should have an idea.
This is news to me.
Sorry, go ahead.
Listen up, Gareth. Yeah. So you want to have in mind, I think, how much money you need to be making in a month in order for it to be practical for you to be deriving your income from poker. And that may determine things like how much you play in a month. There are certainly things you can do to increase the likelihood of you earning X dollars in a month. I mean, it may just be beyond your control, and you certainly don't want to end up at a point where you're like tilting trying to hit a certain number. So I mean, I can see some danger attached to this, but I can also see that there is a self-motivational advantage to it, which is that if you haven't yet made the amount of money that you need to make in a month, that you might need to put in some extra hours, or you may determine that you're going to have to do something to improve your win rate, or just plan on putting more. I mean, it gives you an idea of how much you need to play in a month. If you have a rough idea of your hourly rate, then it might also mean that you have to put in extra hours towards the end of a certain month or something like that. So I mean, I can see it having some advantage as long as you're not tying too much of your self-worth into the achievement of that goal.
See, now this again seems like a better argument against goal setting than for goal setting, because all the things that you just mentioned as possible benefits of having a goal like that could be accomplished much better just by monitoring your bankroll, monitoring your win rate, monitoring your savings. And that's all stuff you should be doing just as part of your management of your own career if you're a professional. Like if we hire an accountant at work, like the accountant shouldn't have to set a personal goal of opening up Excel in the morning, you know? Like, I mean, that's just part of the job. And monitoring your bankroll and knowing something about variance and choosing your games appropriately and all these things, that's just part of being a professional.
Yeah, I really am torn, because on the one hand, I see, let's take my playing micro stakes Zoom. I'm not guaranteed to make money, but for all intents and purposes, I should consider myself guaranteed to make money in the games. Like, setting a dollar value goal might not be the worst thing, because in the sense it is under my control in terms of how much I put into it. I also, like the poker player you described, Nate, should be like organized along those lines, but he might not be like addicted to the grind, and he might look into the future and say, hey, I want to take it easy in August, let's say. So I should really create a disciplined regime for myself the next 3 months instead of taking, I'm just going to use myself as an example, instead of taking every Tuesday off and not playing much on Wednesdays. And this might actually clue me into the reality of, hey, if I have this goal, the reality is I'm going to have to work X hard. Because in my case, I think there's a real tendency to just play within the month. And once the month's over, like, forget the results and actually just continue to forget the results as you go. And Tendler talks about this a little bit, how players who have performed at a high level or who have done something that merits like a sense of accomplishment lose sort of confidence because of the fact that they're not, like, in a way results oriented. You know, they just have this memorylessness of the past and the future, because they're all process. They're all process all the time.
I think maybe we're conflating like making goals and planning a little bit. And I mean, I guess what the argument I'm kind of making, that I think, I don't know if I'm distorting Jared's argument or not, but I mean, goal setting can be helpful in motivating planning. And it may not be necessary, but for some people, it may help them to motivate their planning. Because I do see a lot of people who are professionals make what seem to me kind of poor choices about the games they choose to play or when they choose to play. And it seems to be because, like, all they're doing is just saying, like, well, I play tournament poker for a living, so when there are poker tournaments, I play them. And there's really not a lot of thought into, you know, specific, like, you know, it's always seemed crazy to me that someone could be playing on a Sunday, like the $500 tournament on Poker Stars, and also like a $5 rebuy. If there's any level of distraction at all coming from like a $5 tournament that you're playing, if that's reducing your ability to play well in a $500 tournament by, I don't know, by even like 3 or 4%, then it's kind of nullifying the advantage of having entered that $5 tournament at all.
Wait. Sorry. Can I just run out the numbers here pretty quick? Like, for an expert player, that $500 tournament is maybe like the best have a 25, 30% ROI. Is that about right for a big tournament? I'm not really up on that these days.
I think for the Sunday 500 on Stars, I think it's probably higher than that.
Oh, okay. So like a good. Oh. Okay, so a good player stands to make $225, something like that. Maybe.
Yeah, the best players, I think it might be more in the neighborhood of $300 to $400.
Okay, that's fine. But we're talking about like a good player who's doing this right. Like yeah. I mean, so say I have a $225 edge in that tournament, and so when you say reducing the ability to play well by 3 or 4%. So first, I don't know exactly what that means, but something like $15 or $20, is that right?
25. I'm starting to get uncomfortable with this, but go on.
Yeah. Well, I'm just saying, like,
is this Socrates leading?
No. It's Socratic fashion. I'll say that I'm ignorant and I'm only like leading you through obvious questions that are coming to my mind, right? So like,
the question
I don't know.
Is if you're Euthyphro or Glaucon in this exercise, Andrew.
Well, let's follow the argument. And see how well Andrew does here. So $5 rebuy, it's something like a $25 tournament, often very soft. So any player who's got a $225 edge in the $500 tournament could have something like a $40 edge in the $5 rebuy, something like that.
Yeah.
Maybe more. So all of a sudden, that's looking like a pretty good choice to me, even if it cuts down your expectation in the $500 tournament by a little bit.
Okay, so pretend I use slightly different numbers. I mean, my point is that I think it's often a mistake to be distracting yourself, particularly if it's a matter of getting distracted later in the tournament. Like, I think it very well may make sense if you're starting to get deep in like the $500 tournament and you happen to be in like a $5 rebuy at the same time and it's early in the $5 rebuy, to make a conscious decision to more or less ignore that tournament, or to make sure that you're giving full focus to the tournament that you're deep in, and just kind of letting the other one play off on the side, for instance, if you're going to enter it at all.
Absolutely. Do you think people don't do that?
I don't know. I'm sure there are some people who don't. I think it's not as easy to do as some people might assume that it is. Like, I've definitely watched videos of people multi-tabling a number of tournaments and like not even knowing which tournament it is that they're making decisions in while they're making those decisions.
That's stupid.
And I also think in terms of like setting your schedule, I think there are a lot of people who just feel obligated to play like every single tournament that there is on a Sunday. It's like, I have to play the warm up and I have to play everything all the way through the second chance or through like whatever it is that starts even later than that. Like, not really setting a schedule or saying like, I want to play X dollars of tournaments every week or anything like that. Just kind of saying like, well, there are good tournaments that are going, so I'll sit down and play them.
Yeah.
I do think some of this, the culture of playing the full schedule, I do think that that's gotten harmful, and a lot of people didn't analyze that very closely. But then again, like, tournament players have made almost every kind of career management mistake that anyone could possibly make. I mean, cash game players have too. I just, like, if you go back through 3 years of archives of the community multi-table tournament forum on 2+2, like, I think a lot of the dogmas are just outright insane. But sorry, I cut Gareth off. What do you have to say about that, Gareth?
No, I think we're reaching a good synthesis. Yeah, I just think back to playing Scoop 2 weekends ago. I played kind of full schedule. I think I played like 13 tournaments on the Sunday, and I was four tabling cash at the same time. But there's kind of an organic way the schedule of the day develops, that if you space out the tournaments evenly, getting towards the end of the day, when I was in the money in the one $200 tournament, like the most important by far of all the tournaments, everything had sort of concluded and I could just sit out cash and just watch. You know, I think that happens a lot, since the tournament that goes much longer than the others is likely to be going, I don't know what tournament this is. I think that happens when you're just firing up like the start of the day or the first like 4 hours of the day, and you have, you know, 20 tournaments at all.
Yeah, you're on like, the first couple
in your
levels.
Face. Yeah, exactly. So there is some organic way that you start paying attention, because you're not going to go, I don't know, I think I was playing like 8 or 9 hours in one of the scoops. You know, you're just not going to play 8 hours every tournament.
Right.
Fair enough.
Anything else we want to say about goals or self-discipline?
That they're not as good as just planning properly in the first place, but a proxy for planning well in the first place if you, for whatever reason, can't do that.
Yeah, I mean,
yeah,
I do think
I like that. Yeah.
I don't really identify it with with it that much, but I think that it does seem to be true of a lot of people in the poker world. The point he makes in terms of self-discipline, that there are a lot of people who found themselves in poker precisely because they didn't want to have to be disciplined. You know, they didn't want to have to deal with the disciplines of school or the disciplines of a typical like 9-to-5 office job. And so that's why they're in poker. I mean, I can see how that would be a leak for a lot of people to realize that it's actually more difficult because, I mean, it's in many ways easier to have someone else imposing the discipline on you than to have the responsibility of disciplining yourself. That makes sense to me as something that a lot of people might have a problem with.
Is his talk about responsibility in that discipline chapter? He says some things on responsibility I just want to highlight. He's really good on it, I think.
Yeah, I think there's a section called Taking Responsibility in the self-discipline chapter. That's probably what you're talking about.
Yeah, that's right. Well, I don't know. This one sentence stuck out to me where he says, in poker, there's always some way to accept more responsibility. And yeah, that really resonates with me. I think that's really great insight that a lot of players don't take on. Because sort of under the same guise as not being results oriented, like, hey, I'm an MTT player and I lost, like, some guys are playing for like, you know, mid four figures on Sundays. Like, hey, I lost 6K like six Sundays in a row or something. But, you know, we can't be results oriented about that. So I'm just going to be blasé moving forward. And I just think this doctrine of not being results oriented is good for individual decisions, but in the grander scheme of things, hey, you decided to get into this. You actually are responsible for all the possible outcomes that could happen. And I think a lot of players would benefit from taking more responsibility because I kind of see taking responsibility for something as a type of free roll. Like, it's empowering to take responsibility for outcomes. And if you happen to take responsibility for something that happened that you're not even accountable or responsible for, that's just like, hey, you're even more responsible, like, you know, like you're even stronger, willing to take on, shoulder more of the blame for what's happened.
Yeah, and especially from a expected result point of view, if you worry a little bit about some things that you shouldn't be worrying about, like that's a little bit bad, right? But if you don't worry about things that you should be worrying about results-wise, like that can be terrible, terrible. And this idea of not being results-oriented, I mean, everybody has to understand that there are huge swings involved being an MTT player, but for a lot of people, that's just turned into an excuse not to take responsibility. I think you're exactly right. And this is something I'll just rip myself off here. Something I wrote in a trip report a couple years ago is that if I had a dollar for every time somebody's busted out of a World Series tournament and said, nothing I can do. But in fact, there was a lot they could have done. And right. It was pretty obvious. Like, you know, you aren't entitled to go broke with top pair or 30 big blinds just because you don't want to make a hard decision. And in some sense, if you were playing against a perfect computer, you would have to go broke. You aren't entitled to do that. You know, you aren't, like, nobody's going to show up and just cut you a check for walking in the door. Yeah. You know, it's up to you to pay. Yeah, it's up to you to pay maximal attention all the time. You know, like, if you miss something and some guy's opening range was a lot different than what you lazily assumed it was, I mean, that's on you, and that's a big mistake. So
yeah, I was kind of probably a little harsher than I should have been because I was at the table and not really like fully paying attention to his story or like the emotional state that was behind his story. But a friend of mine came over to me while I was playing in the 1500-hour WSOP event yesterday and was telling me about the hand that he went out on. And he was like, well, I had 6-4 of hearts and the flop was like 6-4 jack. It was like an 8-way limped pot. And we checked it around, which I didn't say this, but already I was like, well, why did you check? But
yeah.
And then the turn was something that gave him 2 hearts. And now he's got like bottom 2 pair and 2 hearts. And he's like, I bet, and someone else raised. And, you know, so I shoved. And I was like, well, I'd probably just call the raise. I mean, unless you thought he was raising and getting it in with less than bottom 2. And I think his thinking was just like, well, I've got, you know, I've got 2 pair plus I have a flush redraw. So I have a hand that's good enough to get all in, which is true, but it doesn't make it the most plus EV move, of course.
Yeah. It doesn't give the guy a bluff frequency that,
right,
in that spot.
It's justified that. And so I mean, I think I would just kind of like dismissively was like, yeah, just call that. And you know, he ended up like from things that he texted me later, I could tell that he was actually like beating himself up kind of seriously over not playing the hand that way. But yeah, I mean, I think that maybe is an example of, and I wish I'd done it more gently, but of my kind of calling his attention to something that he was initially just kind of trying to write it off as like, oh, it was just, I had two pair and a flush draw, what could I do? And, in fact, I think there was something he could have done differently.
Yeah. I mean, the funny irony here is that one thing that's often going on in people's minds when they do this is that it's very hard to criticize somebody for getting it in. Like, it feels a lot worse, and you feel like you have more to justify if the jack pair is on the river and you still end up bluff catching, check calling, or if an ace comes on the river and you end up shoving or something like that. There are a lot of things that can feel sort of icky on the river, and it feels less icky to put it in with two pair and a flush draw, right? And nobody makes fun of you for that. And I think, it's a sign of how well he's chosen his poker friends, that the first person he talks to is actually somebody who'll give him a really hard time for for shoving with a two pair and a flush draw on that spot.
Well, I might have also had a financial interest in the outcome, which is probably part of why he was talking to me, and also why he took it more personally when I criticized the way that he played it.
I see. Well,
that's different. There was a better line available, so I mean, there's no two ways about that. I don't think.
No, it's I just wish I had been somewhat gentler in my presentation. it is an interesting thing too in terms of taking responsibility, because I've sold some action. It's no mystery to Nate that I've sold some action in the WSOP tournaments that I'm playing this year, and I'm not that accustomed to playing on not 100% my own money. It's still somewhat new to me, and so it's always a little bit like when you do go out of a tournament on something that is either like arguably, or not even go out, just when you make something that's either arguably a mistake or definitively a mistake. I mean, it's one thing to be accountable to yourself for that mistake and be like, oh, my mistake cost me money. It's weirder when it's like, well, my mistake cost someone else money. Because, of course, I mean, I don't think backers, and Nate, correct me if I'm wrong, expect that you're going to play flawlessly, or they kind of understand that, that your mistakes are part of what they're paying for. And if you were really capable of playing flawlessly, they'd probably be paying a much higher markup than they were. So, I mean, to some extent, you're kind of accepting. And I know as when I've backed people, I accept that they're going to make mistakes sometimes, and I have some idea of what kind of mistakes they're inclined to make. But
thank God.
But there's still there's still that element of like, well, it's one thing to get bad beat on someone else's money. It's a different thing to lose chips as a result of a hand that you maybe played badly, or even if you don't feel like you played it badly, you're still worried about the perception that you played it badly when you're playing on someone else's money.
Yeah, I mean, I still worry about that. And I had the great luck, the first people who ever backed me for any extended period of time, actually the only people who ever backed me for an extended period of time, they would get more frustrated. In fact, like the only time they would get sort of frustrated or critical of me when I was reporting any tournament to them was when I made it sound like everybody else at the table was terrible or whatever, like that they wanted to hear about the mistakes and they wanted to talk through the mistakes, and that was okay and that was a part of it. And like if it was a cash game, if I said, oh, everybody was terrible, I mean, sometimes it was true and I had to convince them of that. But like there was this incredible look of relief when I would say something like, okay, and then I got into this triple draw pot with this woman, and she was one of the really good players at the table, and so this is why I played it this way. This is really tough, and probably she's going to outplay me in this spot. Then there was a sense that of real relief, and like, okay, like Nate's got a realistic perspective on this, and I think so I'm grateful for that, really.
Yeah, I think that last phrase, has a realistic perspective, so helpful. You guys had a really nice conversation with Tommy about, Andrew said, oh, I just think about mistakes as something that's built in. Mistakes are going to happen, and I accept that. And yeah, if I have any mental game leak that I really need to work on, I have none of the like just world hypothesis leaks, but I have mistake tilt, and it's like, I don't know, the more I reflect on it, the more it's like seems pretty severe that I am way too harsh on myself for making mistakes. Because really, I mean, you play so many hands, like mistakes are just going to happen. You have to accept that. But instead I just sort of punish myself mentally. If there's like a session where mistakes happened, like I just tell myself, hey, that shouldn't happen. When instead there's a much better way to go about it. You should accept it. And then you should work on, mistake reduction per 1,000 hands or whatever the case may be.
Let me be clear. When I say that I accept it, I mean in an academic sense. I don't mean that I never that I'm like entirely zen about my own mistakes. Yeah, right. But
I didn't mean that. But I just mean you put it so in such a nice way for me, because I'm like, oh yeah, I'm still a mistake tilt fish.
Yeah, it was pretty hard for me to get out of. So first, there's accepting your mistakes, or at least not going nuts when you make a mistake. And then second, there's trying to reduce mistakes. And for a long time, I was really good at generally cultivating a non-tilting mindset, you know, like going for walks and feeling good and being calm and not getting angry when I took a bad beat. But it took a while longer still for me to make a mistake, then not only not go on tilt and not only think about my whole frame of mind, but to actually diagnose the thought process that led to the mistake, like the specific thought process. Like, I got the turn raising range wrong. Like, there was something I did wrong here. I wasn't accounting for stack sizes in the right way. Oh, that was a five-handed pot on the flop. So really, this bet was very honest. Something, you know, and that should really be step one. But a lot of the culture around adjusting to mistakes is just on a very emotional plane. It's a lot of don't get angry, you know, be calm in the first place and all this. And I think actually sometimes people miss that you should really diagnose things at a more granular level.
Yeah, excellent. Yeah, I'm the same way. Like, it's not real obvious that I'm suffering from mistake tilt. So it's kind of insidious because I'm even keeled and it, but it's like, it's really in post session, it's really something that just hurts my confidence that doesn't need to. That's the main thing I think that's happening, is I'm looking at a session and saying, hey, look at all these mistakes. Why do you suck? Like, you know, in the heat of the moment, I'm not, I don't know if this surprises you guys, but I'm not prone to like wild monkey tilt. but it's afterwards where, you know, I should be like gaining confidence from like a session well performed. Instead, I'm just thinking about all the mistakes I made, and I'm not thinking about them in like that, the way you just described, which seems to me to be very productive and yeah, just helpful.
When I talk to my students about doing post-game analysis or you know, trying to identify mistakes that they made during a session, or even to some extent like a warm-up or pre-game sort of thing, where maybe they review certain mistakes that they want to focus on during their upcoming session, or certain things that they want to try to improve or make sure that they don't do, I also encourage them to try to identify, like if they're going back through a session and looking for mistakes, I also encourage them to try to identify some of the best hands that they played or some examples of improvement, which I think is helpful on a couple of levels. I mean, one is just to mitigate the harmful effects. I mean, I think there have been like actual studies where if you like tell a person that they're stupid or have like a low score on IQ or something like that, like they actually will score lower on a test than if you tell them that they're smart and then give them a test or something like that. And so, I mean, I think that there really is a danger. Like if all you do is you go through and look at a bunch of hands that you played badly and then you sit down to play, you probably are going to play less well than if you also look at some hands that play well. So I think it's helpful simply from a kind of self-confidence standpoint, but I also think it's helpful. And I know the zone stuff has been a little controversial with from Jared's book, but I think just in terms of like having an idea of what does it look like when I'm playing well, whether or not you think that's exactly what he means by being in the zone, having an idea of when I'm really playing well, this is what I'm capable of. This is what it feels like when I'm playing well. These are the kinds of things that I'm doing. I think that is helpful to kind of get in that mindset, or to say like, you know, when I'm playing well, I'm running through and thinking about my opponent's ranges and I'm making a disciplined laydown of a big hand. Like that's an example of what it means for me to be playing well. I think that can be helpful to get into that mental place where you're able to do those sorts of things in your next session. If you can identify what went well in a previous session and why, and what did it feel like when you were playing your A game.
Agree.
Any last impressions of overall impressions of the book? I know, Gareth, you said you had some.
Well, I just thought it was kind of spare. Like, it's a short book, and I thought it was kind of lacking in like a fullness of content in general. But at the same time, I think its predecessor, along with Elements of Poker, makes up a veritable toolbox for the aspiring poker professional. I was so surprised, actually, how much I liked Tommy's book. In some ways, because he reinforced some of my own ideas. I was like, yeah, I'm so smart for thinking this. when he said things like you shouldn't even think of your opponents as like human beings. You know, they're just trees in a forest that you're navigating.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know how I came to that, but I came to that idea myself early. A lot of the way Elements is written, you could just tell that he actually grinded. He was actually doing it, you know? And it's hard for me to put a finger on how you can tell that, hey, this guy's authentically a grinder. He's gone to the store and bought rubber bands, and you know, that's the way he's lived his life. I guess, I don't know, just from one professional to another, like, I could just detect that authenticity and the lessons. And he's done it for a long time, and he's taken the time to write this book of succinct lessons of, hey, here's my like decade plus of experience for you for like $30. I just think that's like, it's a huge resource.
Then
I think Jared has a lot to contribute as well. So I think those three books, just whatever criticisms we can offer, probably legitimate criticisms, I think they're a great foundation, mental game foundation.
Can I offer a 5-second summary? So first off, good job, Gareth. That was all. Second off, can I offer my brief final thoughts about the last part of the book?
Please.
I thought there was some useful stuff there, but the analogies between the physical and the mental were a bit hasty and not often helpful and not always accurate, or at least I wanted to hear more and they didn't seem obvious to me. So there was definitely some good stuff in there about what you should be trying to do and about how to sort of build up mental endurance and things like that. But ultimately, I found myself not entirely trusting a lot of the claims you made about how you can prepare for poker the same way you would prepare for golf or something like that. So that's what I thought.
Yeah, I mean, and I don't think this is anything Jared would even really disagree with, but I do think he lacks, and I like the way that you put it, Gareth, the authenticity. Like, he's not a grinder, you know, and he did come right out and say that on the show. Like, he doesn't have a ton of poker playing experience himself. So, you know, what he has is experience of other people telling him what it's like, or trying to see secondhand, like, issues that they've developed as a result of those. But there are a lot of times when, I mean, it's too loaded of a word, really, but to say, I mean, he kind of felt like a poser when you hear him actually talk about poker, because, you know, he'll say stuff that just sounds kind of like cliched, you know, like, if you're dreaming of playing at Rail Heaven, then you can. And I don't know, I just, like, that's not how poker players talk. And it's not really, like, I don't think most people are, I mean, they're maybe dreaming of it in a very abstract sense, but I don't think that there are that many people who think that that's a thing that they're actually going to be doing at some point, or I don't know. It just, he doesn't talk like a poker player, and I do think he knows that, but I do think it's hurts the book a bit, because it's, he's not as directly experienced, and it probably does contribute to, as you say, Nate, some bad analogies, because he's trying to relate it to things that he is more familiar with.
Especially because a lot of his experience, I think, is not only secondhand, but specifically with Dusty Schmidt, and who's not a standard person. I mean, I'm not Dusty, and I don't want to be Dusty, and I think that Dusty's experience, and by extension, Jared's secondhand experience, is even a bit non-standard.
I mean, that's sort of like ad hominem aside, I think Jared's worked with a lot more people than just Dusty. But I think what we're getting to is, like, he's much more of a diagnostician than one to offer firsthand advice. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the book is sort of like, hey, I'm a diagnostician. Here's a book so you can diagnose yourself. And then the conclusion is, do the work. That's the headline of the conclusion. And yeah, I just got to that part of the book and I was like, okay, here's where he like wraps it all up, because he's been pretty stingy with detail, those granular items that Nate talks about. He's been pretty stingy with those. And like, literally the conclusion is not even a page. Like, I don't even, like, it's so lacking in content. It's just do the work. So a lot of it, I think, gets like, Jared gets credit for writing material that other people haven't yet, and you know, approaching things from a diagnosis perspective, but it could have been done a lot better, certainly.
I think that's a very good way of putting it. Like, it's a valuable book because there's not a lot of other books like it, and I do think it's, although it's certainly comparable to mental to Elements of Poker, in that it's trying to accomplish some of the same things. I do think he goes about it in a pretty different way, so that he's not really competing directly with Tommy Angelo, or it's not just a question of like which of these books does it better. But I could certainly see what Jared is going for in his books being executed in a better way, but I don't think that book has really been written yet.
Yeah, I actually do think that a lot of what you could get out of Jared's book, you could get better out of Tommy's book. I mean, maybe not all of it, but I think the goals are pretty similar.
Yeah.
Hey, wait, can I ask Gareth one more question? It's something that we didn't get to last week.
Of course.
Yeah. Or 2 weeks ago. So it's a door number one, door number two question from the book. Door number one is a guy who's been beating 1-2 no limit for 5 big blinds per 100 over a large sample, like a recent large sample.
It wasn't that door long. I think it was 40,000 hands.
40,000 hands. Okay, pretty good sample. Door number two is somebody who is beating the same game over the same sample for, was it 2 or 3 big blinds per 100?
I'm not sure we even got a win rate on him. Maybe we should just look this up.
Okay. we can look. Yeah.
I think it was just a qualitative description. I don't think.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Player number one has been beating 1-2 for 5 big blind per 100 over 40,000 hands. Player number two, he just says you have a solid win rate. Your coach thinks you are doing well. You're fixing the C game mistakes you have been working on. You better understand the instructions from training videos. You feel confident in your play and tilt has not been an issue.
Which guy would you rather have playing your money, Gareth?
Oh, the qualitative, like, not even close. Not even close. I just think, I think, the way I'm reading it wrong, but the variance of a 5 big blind per 100 sample over 40,000 hands is just such a huge monster out there that we don't understand, and that, you know, how big it is. So I think the potential that, like, if we're talking about, hey, me giving this guy 5K of my bankroll, I would definitely want to give it to the second guy, assuming like the coach is, you know, good, or the coach is Andrew, I just like snap call.
That's the thing. A lot is written into that second one in kind of vague ways. Like, you have a solid win rate. Like, how does that compare to 5 big blind per 100? Like, I feel like that's almost cheating to say that player gets to have a solid win rate, because we have a specific number for the other player.
And also, like, the variance point doesn't entirely work the way you want it to. So if a 5 big blind win rate is somehow dubitable or somehow not great evidence, then 2 big blind win rate is even much, 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 yeah, much more, much more. I mean, like, the tails of it matter a lot. I mean, there was a time in my career when I wanted to increase my win rate, not so much to win more money, but just to drastically cut down my number of 100 big bet losing streaks or something. I mean, it's like, the way this affects the tails of the distribution is enormous. But
is the second guy over 40,000 hands as well?
No, we don't get a right. We don't get a sample for him. And like you said, it matters a lot who the coach is. Like, the fact that someone you're paying tells you you're good is potentially dubious evidence, depending on who that person is. I've definitely had people contact me, but like, one of the things that I have on my like contact me form for people who are interested in coaching is like whether you've had coaching before. And I've definitely had people like name drop names that I've never heard of. They're like, I've had coaching with so-and-so, and I'm like, well, I don't know who that is.
It's as much of a monster as variance is. Self-deception and lazy coaching, and the feeling that you're understanding things because you're winning. I mean, the probability of watching a training video and not thinking that you're learning what the video is teaching you, given that you're winning at a solid win rate, is almost zero. And if you're winning, yeah. So if I had to put 5K in one of the other of those guys, I got the first guy, and it's not even close.
If we're understanding the terms the same way, like, I changed my answer, but it wasn't entirely clear to me that, I don't know, I guess I read the second scenario and just envisioned a quixotic, like, land of wonderful, you know? And the first guy just brought to mind, like, the disparity in my cash game results from last weekend to this weekend, you know, and like how big that was. It's insane. People really underestimate variance. Yeah,
I think that's definitely true. So if we have two listeners out there who fit this profile, maybe we can get some kind of bet going.
So thanks to everyone who's been following along with the book club. Thanks again to Jared for coming on the show and talking about both his personal life and the book specifically, and for being good natured with our criticisms of it. And we are not going to be doing a book club for the month of June, as we said earlier in the show. Just too much going on with the WSOP. I'm actually even a little concerned about our ability to line up guests, just because everyone, myself included, is going to be pretty busy this month. So we'll kind of have to play it by ear in terms of how things shake out with the podcast this month, but definitely interested in bringing you a lot of content. Those of you who've been following my blog, I've been putting up a lot of trip report, entirely unpoker related, just like a road trip, my getting to Las Vegas. That's nearly completed, and I'm about to, I just posted this morning a What's Your Play coming from a WSOP event. So you can expect now to see a lot more poker content starting to show up on the blog, and probably we'll be discussing that some of that on the show as well. So like I say, I'm not sure where things are going to stand in terms of lining up guests for this month, but hopefully we should be able to bring you a lot of interesting discussion, and hopefully we've already brought you some this episode.
So instead of reading a book, you're playing 15 World Series of Poker tournaments. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, essentially.
Tough life.
There's going to be a real dearth of content there. You know, you're just going to have exciting news basically every 2 days.
Yeah, hopefully.
Andrew's tweeting at Thinking Poker. You should follow him on Twitter.
And thank you, Gareth, for coming on here discuss the book, and also to tell us about your adventures in Istanbul. Stay safe and have a good time in Marbella or Marbella? I would think it was the latter.
Yeah, with the double L. Yeah, I think it depends if you're going with the Busquet or Busquet interpretation of words. But yeah, Marbella, I assume as well.
That's yeah, you stole me 50 cents for that, by the way. Or was it a dollar?
I think it was a dollar.
How could you? Andrew was so certain on the. I couldn't believe it.
I just feel like
I can cut this from the actual episode. But
that's fine. I mean, I feel ridiculous even saying this now that I actually think about it. But I'm pretty sure that's how Mike Johnson pronounced it on the PokerCast. But
okay,
right. So but he also calls me Foucault every time I go on there. So
yeah, it's like a George Costanza picking up women. You just do the opposite. You know? He gets every name wrong. No, I just because you studied in French, right?
No. You, I mean, I know how you would pronounce it in French. I just wasn't sure if that was how he actually pronounced it. I wasn't doubtful about the French pronunciation of it.
Wait, which one's Mike? I can't remember which one's Mike and which one's Adam.
Mike has a really pronounced Canadian accent. And he's Adam is the more like poker expert guy.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. I understand your shame. Although, I mean, really, like, if you just pronounce everything the way that they do, it's probably a pretty good heuristic.
No.
I mean, I mean, betting between them and me, I'm not sure is good, but, you know, of course, like, most information you get on the 2+2 PokerCast is going to be accurate, right? So
Mike is specifically famous for mispronouncing names, though, like that. And that's why I felt as soon as I started citing him as, like, my source on that, I was like, oh, I'm just going to sound ridiculous.
See, when you make a mistake and lose a bet, you don't just try not to go on tilt. You analyze the thought process that led to the mistake. And then you shame yourself and don't do it again. So...